This is Carolina Hernandez. I'm with the University Archives, and today I am with Deshaun McKinney. We are in the Paul Bunyan Room at Memorial Union. The date is April 2nd, 2015. And let's see, I want to start off first by asking you to spell your name out for me.
Again, Deshaun, D-E-S-H-A-W-N. McKinney, M-C-K-I-N-N-E-Y.
Thank you, and thank you for joining me here today. Mm-hmm. So let's start off with your childhood, and just if you could let us know where you were born and what it was like growing up, wherever you were.
I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which isn't too far from Madison. As far as what it was like growing up, it was many things. I grew up in poverty. I've been well acquainted with it, and understanding like the effects it can have on a family and on individuals. So I think I grew up understanding the small scale effects of like systematic oppressions and issues just from living in it. Not necessarily that I always understood it in those terms, but I grew up in that environment, and Milwaukee itself is a city, as are most large cities in the nation, like suffering from those effects. So, you know, I've seen that, how it impacts people. And I've seen certain vices impact, like my father, like as a result of this, among other things. I think I grew up in a household that was never necessarily stable, in a family that was necessarily stable. Went to a K through eight school that wasn't the best. Recently, I remember doing like performances and having talkbacks and people asking about education or something. And that's when it was the first time I thought about like my K through eight education in a while, and this was a few months ago. And I just recall that I don't remember like learning anything during that time. So like that's my whole like elementary, middle school experience. But looking back, I don't feel like I took anything away from it in terms of academics, because it just wasn't like a strong program, and there were so many other issues going on. Like there were fights every day, you know, like I remember times where we found like bullets on the school bus and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
So that, and I remember in seventh grade, like we never actually had a teacher. It was just subs like the whole year.
Wow.
So stuff like that, you know, growing up in that school. But that's part of like the experiences I have growing up and making who I am. High school, I went to an amazing high school, actually, Rufus King, which is an international baccalaureate school, which is like special programs. Like there's AP, but then there's IB.
I did a year of IB before I moved, so.
Nice, yeah. So I went to that high school, and it was the number one high school in the state, and one of the top high schools in the country, actually, which is, it stands in opposition to like much of what Milwaukee is, and even the neighborhood itself, like that King is in, you know, there were people on the football team getting robbed after school in that neighborhood, but it's still like the number one school in the state, you know, like across the street, they're like dilapidated houses and stuff. So it's just it's a weird kind of parallel reality that that school offers, but it's a great thing. And like, I took so much away from that school. And I learned a lot, met a lot of great people, and I'm grateful for that. So, you know, I had a very interesting kind of upbringing. I saw like both sides of what, like, you know, all I know what the bottom's like, but then I also know what it's like to get like a proper education and have like hope and see things on a larger scale. So, yeah.
How did you decide? Did you decide to go there, or was that based on where you were living? How did you get involved in
to Rufus King?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a decision. I remember like in eighth grade having to, in eighth grade, I think, when whatever time during the year, we have to figure out, what's going to happen next, what high school am I going to go to. And initially, I was just going to go to a school called Vincent High School, because that's where my older brother was at currently. And I was just like, that'd be cool, like just to be in school with my older brother. And I wasn't like really shopping around at school as much. Like I wasn't super picky about what high school I went to. So I went to Vincent's like open house or whatever they have. But then I think my eighth grade teacher suggested that I check out Rufus King. So I went to that open house as well. And I think it was like looking at the different like orgs that the school offers or whatever, and there was the journalism one. And like, I'd never done anything like that before, and I wasn't like set on it, but then, you know, like my mom was there, and she kept pushing, like, oh, you should do it and do it. And they were like, yeah, she's right. And it was like a whole thing. So that was, I guess I saw like, oh, this is a place where like there's, you know, these different kind of opportunities for me. And after being in that environment, I just felt like it was a better place for me. I felt like I could get more away from it. Or maybe that I felt like I belonged there more. I'm not sure exactly, but I remember leaving that open house, and I was pretty set, like, I want to go here. And also there's that part of me that I want to get the best education. Like, I know, or at least want to see if I'm like good enough for that. Like, if I could get into the school, right? So I think they had their admissions requirements, like you tested into the school or something. Mm-hmm. I don't really remember. It was a while ago. But yeah, so I left that open house feeling like I wanted to go there, and then I got in eventually, and so I decided to go.
Why did you decide to go to UW-Madison?
A couple of reasons. My freshman year of high school, I was informed about the PEOPLE program, which is a pre-college, like enrichment, kind of like bridge to college program that they have here on campus. For people within Madison, it starts in like sixth grade, I think, and they come and it's like, you know, they have like counselors and mentors and people helping them academically, giving them opportunities, preparing them for college, basically making sure they get into UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. For people outside of the city, like me, it starts the freshman year of high school. So there's a summer program that every summer you come onto campus, actually, and there's 3 weeks, 3 weeks, 6 weeks. And if you get in, then there's an 8-week like bridge to college program. So I've been here on campus actually every summer since my freshman year of high school, and we take like, there's like study skills classes, maybe like in English or math, and then you get to hang around like with other students who are going through this life from around the state, and you know, you learn, get a little familiar with campus, although you couldn't like wander by yourself or anything, because they didn't trust us as high schoolers to do all that. You have to be with a counselor and like 9 other kids, but you know, in the third year, like after your junior year of high school, you come and you get to actually do an internship in the area of your interest. So I remember journalism was the interest I had then. So I took a class that was with a journalism like professor, and then my internship experience, I actually worked for the radio station, WSUM. So I got time to like practice that. You know, we did some broadcasting on there, like news broadcasting. We also like helped like do live like shows on the radio, which was intense, but it was really fun. You know, it's kind of nerve-wracking doing all that, because you can mess up easy, and like all those like FCC regulations, whatever. You can't have like 30 seconds of dead air, then they're like, that's actually like against the rules or something. Wow. So it's like nerve-wracking, but it was a really cool experience. And I took a lot away from it. So they give you, you know, that professional experience, so you can see whether this is for me or this isn't something I really like. So I went through all that. But then my senior year, I started getting into art like my junior year of high school, like poetry and stuff like that. I would always like grow up writing stories. I always wanted to be an author, and I still do, but I would like write stories in like middle school and stuff. Like, they were really bad, basically just like exact copies of other stuff that I really liked. But back then I thought it was dope, and people liked it for some reason. So, but then like my junior year of high school, I started getting more into like poetry and started writing it, practicing it. And then senior year, I decided to join this thing called Writers Club at King, because people kept telling me about it, like the other years, like, you should join it. And I was like, man, that sounds whack. Like, it does not sound fun or something I would like to do. So I just didn't do it. But senior year, I stopped in, and it turns out it was like a poetry slam team, basically, because Milwaukee has a high school poetry slam league.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that's what the focus of it was. So you need to do competitive poetry around the city. So I got into that, you know, started doing, you know, slams, competing around the city, writing. And through that, they told us about this thing called First Wave, which is a program here at UW-Madison, Urban Arts Scholarship, 4-year full tuition scholarship. So I heard about it, and they told us, like, there's this thing, festival called Passing the Mic, which First Wave holds in the fall, like in October, and it's like a weekend festival where they bring high schoolers from around like the country to come and experience like this art in like what it could be, like this hip-hop theater and everything, and also interact with each other and get them familiar with the program and with Madison. They get all these opportunities, and it's like a really good experience for both us and for the high schoolers. So they introduced us to that, said they could take a few people. In my mind, I was like, I don't really care much about this First Wave thing, but we get a hotel for the weekend, that sounds cool. So I was like, yes, I'll do it. And so I was one of the people, and we came up to Madison. And then we were watching these performances, and I just remember the weekend, it was just so like eye-opening to me. Like, they had first off, just really, like, some of the performers they brought in were just, like, amazing. But then seeing the First Wavers perform, too, I remember there was one of the women in First Wave. She got up on stage, and she was rapping, and then the song, or actually a few of them, like, the women were, like, taking over that weekend. And they were just, like, rapping or doing poetry, and it was just, like, amazing. So much talent that I saw, and then I left that weekend, like, again, I want to see, like, if I'm good enough for that. So I wanted to, like, test myself, and, like, I want to be a part of that community of, like, elite, talented people. So I decided to send in my application for First Wave. Being a procrastinator I am, I did it. Like, I remember scrambling the night it was due. It's like 10, it's due at 11, and it's, like, a whole thing. But I did, like, submitted, like, two poems and a rap, and then I just waited to see what would happen. And eventually I got that call that I was accepted into the program. I think that was in, like, February or something. I think I already had been accepted to UW-Madison. I was never that worried about getting accepted into Madison. So now, though, I had First Wave and People Program, like, as things funneling me into Madison. And I was still debating whether I should come here and, like, looking at other schools, like, what would be best for me. Because I wasn't, at that point, I was still trying to choose between, should I do journalism? Or am I just going, like, a different route, which would probably be, like, creative writing or something? And I wasn't set because I was a part of our school newspaper in high school, which was the King's Page. And it was a really great newspaper. Like, we would send it around the country and stuff. But the school, it wasn't supported by, like, well, it never had, like, a secure funding from, like, the school. And throughout high school, we kept getting, like, budget cuts and stuff. So eventually, that was one of the things that had to go because it was like a small operation on campus. There were like 12 of us working it with like a teacher. So they ended up cutting it after my sophomore year. So I did 2 years on it. And then, you know, after that, I was out of it for, you know, the next 2 years. So I started to move away from journalism and started also just growing more like angst with like media in general, like news sources around the country and how they operate and just the problems that come, you know, with national news and how it, you know, it works. So I wasn't sure which path I wanted to go. But I think the final decision kind of came with me saying, okay, I know journalism isn't where, like, I'm at anymore. And so I would choose Madison because, not only because of, like, that, but then there's also this added thing of, like, a programs, particularly First Wave, because that wasn't just, like, an academic or, like, you know, leadership business kind of thing, which is more what People is, but it was also like, you know, there's this creative side of you, like, where your passion is. You've always wanted to do creative writing, and then here's, you're getting paid to go to school for it. And not only that, but you're a part of a community of artists who are also doing this, which is, like, huge inspiration to be around people thinking like that, getting these opportunities. So I saw that as a whole, Madison could just offer so much in the end. And that's when I made that final decision to commit and come here.
That sounds like a really great opportunity that you got to take part of and that kind of funneled you in here. So you didn't even, did you even apply to any other schools?
Yeah, I applied to a few other ones. The one that I was considering most besides Madison was Northwestern because they have a really strong journalism program.
Yeah.
And that's what I would have went there to study. So that was the main one I was considering.
So, and you're currently a sophomore?
Yeah, I think I'm a junior with credits, though. I don't know.
Oh, that's nice.
It's my second year here.
So do you have a major now?
Yeah, I declared my first year, actually, English Creative Writing.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, I'm considering getting a certificate in Afro-Am studies, but with all the stuff I'm trying to do, I don't know if it's possible because I'll be doing, like, a lot of studying abroad and, like, being off campus, so I don't know if I have time.
Yeah.
But
any minors then, or is that kind of the same situation?
Yeah, it's the same thing.
So what other, like, extracurriculars activities have you been involved in beyond the kind of First Wave and People things?
Well, it's interesting, though, because it's kind of not beyond them, because it's kind of like an extension of it, more so First Wave than People. A lot of the opportunities I've gotten them through First Wave. Like, not only are they paying my tuition, but I'm also on the payroll. Like, I work for the office and help, like, plan our events and stuff. I also have an internship with a theater company in Madison, which is Forward Theater Company, and that's also through a First Wave partnership. So I do that. And I'm also a part of the First Wave Touring Ensemble, which is you audition every year, and they choose like four or five artists, and they take them around the country to perform, sometimes internationally, depending on who like pays to bring First Wave out. So we go around and perform. So like all those opportunities are an extension of my being in First Wave. Mm-hmm. And because it's just so many great opportunities that actually not only are they resume building, but they're in all of my areas of interest, you know what I mean? And a big thing too, which is why I want to turn ensemble, is not that I get to perform, because like I can do that here, and I've done that a lot, but I get to travel, which is a huge part of what I wanted to do. Like growing up in Milwaukee and growing up poor in Milwaukee, I never had the chance to like get out of the city. Like I've been to Chicago like before, but that's not a big deal really. That's nothing special really. But like I remember other people in my school would talk about how they've been to this country or whatever, or this state over whatever break. And me, I would just be like, I was in the city still. Like, you know, I was at home or whatever, because we didn't have money for that. So coming into college and just, you know, beyond too, I really want to see the world so bad. And First Wave Touring Ensemble was a way to do that, so which is why I jumped on that opportunity. And that's a lot of what I've been doing in terms of extracurriculars. I've also done, you know, a lot of community work, which is like why we're here. And I've led workshops for students and for different, like at different like schools or, you know, organizations or whatever. And been involved with smaller things, not necessarily like continuous, but like when, you know, opportunities where I can jump on it, I've done things like that.
You've mentioned travel a lot, and you said before that you were interested in studying abroad. Mm-hmm. Have you picked out a place?
Oh, I've picked out many. I'm actually, this summer, I'm going to Shanghai, China, and London. So I'm doing a little country hopping this summer.
That sounds exciting.
Next year, I plan to go to Japan to study abroad, and then I'll also be going to Jamaica to present some research next fall. So got a lot of travel in your mind.
Yeah, wow. That's many more places than I've been to.
Yeah, I'm really trying to take advantage of it all. You know, it's never, I'm a big, huge advocate for like traveling while you're in college, because it's never going to come as easy again. Like you can get, it's just an application process, and then like you're funneled through to like another country, and also there's opportunity to get it paid for, so you can go to another country on somebody else's dime, which is just not a thing in like the real world, hardly. For most of us, that will never be a thing again, so right. I'm a huge advocate for it, and I'm trying to, you know, take advantage as much as I can. I think I'm doing pretty all right so far.
So these are all opportunities through the university?
Yeah, all of them. Yeah, the China is a very specific program. It's like a fully funded thing. The London is a typical UW study abroad, as is the Japan. And the Jamaica thing is, there's this thing called the International Colloquium on Black Males in Education, which I also went to last fall, and it was in Atlanta, and we presented research just surrounding that very issue, like Black Males in Education, like, you know, how to improve, what's it looking like, what are the numbers, the disparities, et cetera, like schools from around the nation, as well as speakers, they come and like meet in this colloquium that goes for like 5 days or something. It's usually international. Last year was the first time it was domestic. And you get to, so UW takes students there, because I think UW was one of like the founding organizations of it with like Ohio State or something. So they take students, there's people program, take students, and Posse are the big UW orgs that like go down there. And there's also like smaller things, like smaller scholarship students can come on. But those are the big ones. And I'm trying to get First Wave to send some students, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. So in all of this work that you've been doing on campus, have you had any kind of mentor figures that have guided you, or anyone that you've really admired in your time at UW?
I don't know if I've necessarily had mentor figures, but I've met a lot of great people while I've been here. And although, like, not necessarily that I have a mentor relationship, like where it's something we're always meeting and, you know, really sitting down and talking these things out, but I've experienced and learned a lot from a lot of people here. You know, I've had some really great professors who, and it's not necessarily like they're even talking or teaching about these issues, but you still take something away from it, and they instill values in you, or like a better sense of self, or you know what I mean, something. And so professors, you know, some faculty, staff, and a lot of First Wave students, because First Wave, one of the pillars of it is activism. So a lot of students in First Wave come from backgrounds where they're doing like grassroots organizing in their communities and things like that. And I didn't come from that. But like being around that, you get those, you know, those values in you. And I've been aware of these issues, and you want to do more, especially when you live it. And like still currently, like, and I, this is a very different world from like if I go back to Milwaukee, you know, like my life has never been as good as it has been in college, in terms of like finances, in terms of like my living space and all of that. When I go back to Milwaukee, it's an entirely different world. From like the second I get back into the city, you just see, like, it just looks different. People move different. Like, you know, like they carry those weights with them wherever they go. So it's a very different world. So here, and with that in mind, I just started, you know, getting involved in that work. And it's also something that in a lot of the spaces I'm in, like being in First Wave, it's a lot of like critical thinking and like deconstruction of these issues, because it's, you know, a lot of theoretical frameworks. And that really goes into like all the art we do, because a lot of people are talking about these issues in their communities or these world issues or whatever is close to them, but they're doing it in the way where you have to really know these issues. And not just know like what they are, but like how they function and what contributes to them and how they move and breathe. So we do a lot of that type of work as a part of our art. So we have these conversations and these discussions all the time. So like, you know, my mind's always churning into stuff and mm-hmm. analyzing things like that. So yeah, and there's just so many people here who've been a part of that.
Ooh, that's good to hear. Moving the conversation a little bit to more Madison in general, mm-hmm. so beyond the campus specifically, what has it been like living here? You kind of touched upon that a little bit, but compared to Milwaukee, what's your general experience been like?
Well, it's a very different world from growing up in inner city Milwaukee, like on the north side. Like Milwaukee is, the north side of Milwaukee, well, first off, it's a hyper-segregated city, right? So like the sides are very, like racially bounded. So the north side is where you're gonna get most black people. That's where I live. So you're used to going outside and seeing like black people and black culture, like whatever that means, and hearing like how black people talk, which is a different thing. So culturally, it's a very different experience. Because here, obviously there's about 1,200 black students on campus out of the 42,000. So it's a very tiny number. And you don't experience things like that. And it's not just because of the numbers, but like blackness is so criminalized in like academic spaces that, you know, it doesn't translate into these classrooms either. So blackness even, it can operate differently on campus as well. So it's so different in that sense. But my experiences have been, I'm very grateful for my experience. Like Madison has been good to me. There's positives and negatives that coexist, you know, in the city and on this campus, but there's just so many opportunities here that I've taken advantage of, and that's really, you know, where my focus is and how my experience has been. I think I have experienced, like, racism on campus, you know, like people saying things, and there's also, like, the microaggressions and stuff that you feel when you're in spaces, or, like, is somebody not sitting next to you in class, or, like, I know friends of mine have stories where it's like, okay, in discussion, everybody break off into groups and it's supposed to be pairs, but the person sitting next to them decided to join another group and make it a group of three, then like work with this person of color. So like, there's those situations where it's just not like nobody spewing that racism at you, but you feel it. It's, you know, you can still feel the heat from it coming off of them. So that's definitely a reality. But I think I've fared better than a lot of my peers here. I don't think I've faced as much like racism or aggression on campus. I mean, except for like, you know, when you're doing the work that I'm doing, then it'll come from all angles and be really explicit, but that's okay, it's whatever. I don't think, and I'm not particularly like struggling here or anything, you know, not in terms of academics or like in my social life things. I don't think I necessarily mesh well with the campus culture. Like, you know, the drinking and partying is not necessarily, that's not my thing really. But I've also found so many alternative outlets. Like, there's the Overture Center that's just right at the top of State Street, which is, to me, such a weird thing to have. Like, it's such a state-of-the-art center where they bring Broadway shows. Like, they just have Book of Mormon here. They're having Lion King next year. Yeah. But if you go out on State Street, it's like drunk kids stumbling and stuff. And it's just like, it's such a weird... And yeah. I also don't think many people understand what that is. Like, having that there, how big that is. Like, they're bringing Broadway shows, and it's just like a 10-minute walk from wherever you live. Mm-hmm. And it's not that expensive. You have so much access to, like, all this amazing art. So it's always been a weird, like, reality, which Madison has a lot of. I also find there's, like, these pockets of hip-hop all around. And that's not something anybody thinks of when they think of Madison. Yeah, like, rap culture, like, which is, first off, First Wave is here, which is a weird thing. Like, why out of all places did it start in Madison, Wisconsin, which is crazy. But I remember last year, they had the international, like, it was like Breaking the Law, which is an international breakdance competition. And it was legit. Like, there were teams from, like, Japan, like, Korea that came.
Wow.
And they were in Union South in, like, the set. And they were, like, actually competing. They had many rounds. Like, there were breakdancers and poppers and everything. And I was just, like, I was shocked. Like, this is Madison. Where does this happen? And that's been, like, a continuous thing. It's so, like, there's all these weird pockets of culture. So I've found it through the communities I'm in, which also is a part of why my experience, I think, has been different from people, because I came in with two communities. Like, I came in knowing hundreds of students, like, of color, which a lot of students don't get. So they're kind of floundering for, like, that first year or first semester, and it can be a struggle, you know? Like, people can go an entire day without seeing somebody that looks like them, which is a hard thing to have to go through. And, you know, it's hard for you to find a place, like, where do I belong? Especially for the students that live in Lakeshore. So I think that also helped me have a smoother transition, because, you know, if I needed somewhere to go, I had those places. Or if I needed an outlet or friends or events, I can get them through those programs or my friends from those programs by extension. So, yeah, my overall, it's been a really positive experience. I know I've seen a lot of friends struggle, though, with a lot of things, particularly, like, social things. And that's not, it hasn't always been race. A lot of sexual orientation stuff, too. People get a lot of hate, and, you know, some of my friends have been, like, really, really bad at times because of the atmosphere, and a lot of people don't like this campus. They don't feel connected to it at all, and this is a big issue within the student of color population, which even transfers to the alumni. Like, a lot of student of color alumni, they won't donate to the university, but they love the programs they came from. Like, they'll praise a First Wave or a People, but they don't want to give the money to the university because they don't feel connected to it or trust the university. So, you know, it trickles up and builds up over the years.
Do you feel like your experience then, largely positive that it is, you know, kind of more the general experience students of color might have on campus, or do you feel like you've just been fortunate in many ways?
I don't think it's the general experience for student of color, because most of the students of color I talk to, like, really go through it while they're here. And, like, a lot of people I know have, like, developed, like, mental health issues while they've been here, and they need to, like, you know, start going to counseling or whatever, or they need places to turn, or they're relying on vices like alcohol and stuff, because they have such a rough time here, you know? So, yeah, I don't think my experience is the typical. And I think I've been fortunate. I also think I come in with a pretty resilient mind and, like, set of experience that kind of helped forge me for, you know, like, whatever comes my way. So I think I deal with things differently and better than a lot of other, like, people and friends that I have and know. So I think that contributes to it as well.
So let's move on to kind of your activism work that you've done here. You already mentioned you didn't really come from a background of activism, but had you done any sort of participation in protests or other activist work before you got to UW?
No, actually, I haven't. Not in Milwaukee. I really didn't get involved in anything like that. I don't think I was ever really, like, plugged into those networks. I also just didn't, like, have, like, a way to get around the city, really. Like, you know, like, my growing up in my parents' house, like, my parents don't have a car. So we would use public transportation, like, all my life. that's what we rely on. And it's just, it's an inconvenient thing. It's also not something that you always want to go about. So it's not like I didn't get around the city that much. Like, I didn't have access to a lot of the city, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't go downtown a lot just to chill, because then I would have to take, like, a 45-minute bus ride and pay the fares and worry about catching the bus back, not missing and all this stuff. So it's just, like, inconvenient, you know? So I didn't travel a whole lot, which is also something, like, you know, you need to get around to wherever it is, whether it's somebody, like, organizing or if there's a protest, like, in the downtown area or something. But I think a lot of it was I wasn't plugged into those networks, though. Like, you, if you don't hear about it, then you just don't know.
Yeah.
So I don't think, like, I can't recall many, like, marches or anything happening in Milwaukee. I know there's some, and, you know, there's work going on in, like, the communities and stuff with different organizations, but it wasn't on my radar at that time. So I wasn't involved in anything till last semester, which the first thing I maybe got involved in, I think, was a march with Young Gifted and Black, where we marched, like, around the Capitol and everything, and then to the county building for PP&J committee meeting, I believe. I think that was the first thing that I was ever involved in. But then there's also the truth that there hasn't been a lot of large-scale, like, movements or actions, rather, happening around the nation until recently. So, although I know there's been stuff that I can't recall, I also know that there hasn't been a lot of it, and especially not, like, heavily televised stuff where the word would get around. So I kind of, like, came along when, like, at the beginning stages of all of these, you know, current movements that are happening.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about Young Gifted and Black? I don't know how heavily involved you've been with them, but
yeah, I can. I mean, I can't say, I don't know, like, how they started or anything, but since I've been getting active, I've been, you know, I've worked with them, and I'm connected to them as a group. I know they're an organization in the community that's really pushing to better things. People don't always agree with the way they operate, so they, you know, they get some harsh critics, but they also get a lot of praise from people in the community. If anything, I know that they give some people hope, which is a huge thing in these day and ages. They're an organization, they focus a lot on the, what they call, like, the violence, in matter, like, state violence. I think that's what the word they use when they address a lot of issues. And what they're talking about is are the vast disparities that happened in Madison. So in 2013, the Race to Equity Report came out, which is basically documenting the disparities between blacks and whites in Dane County. And they found that in many instances they were worse than the national averages in terms of, like, employment, mass incarceration, like, children in foster care, children in poverty, all those things. And they were, like, worse than the national averages, which is a shock to a lot of people, because Madison is often painted as, like, this liberal bastion, very progressive, et cetera, which it has a history of, but that blinds a lot of people to what it is, though. Like, there's still this reality despite this other thing, you know? So Young Gifted and Black does a lot of work surrounding that state violence, trying to lessen those disparities, close those gaps, do things. They did a lot of work surrounding the prisons. There was a proposal to build a new jail, and then there was a proposal to renovate a jail, and they were fighting against both of those. So the new jail didn't get built. I don't think the resolution has been set on the renovations yet. I think that's still up. Recently, they've done a lot of work surrounding, like, the Tony Robinson shooting. They also have, like, a speaker series on campus to help educate people and engage in these conversations, so people are understanding more what state violence is, what these disparities are, or, like, the history of, like, a civil rights movement, or, you know, things that happen in the community, and they just want to educate people. So they're doing a lot of work in the community. They're a very active group. I think a lot of them are, or at least a few of them are UW grads. They also have a member who's actually presented, like, these type of issues and about this, with this information to the UN before. So, like, they're all, like, educated people, very experienced people, dedicated people, who are, you know, in the streets doing this work often. So yeah, it's a good group. they're putting in a lot of work, and I respect that.
Thank you for that. So why did you, well, I should say the first time I heard about you was when the die-in at college library happened, and you kind of spearheaded that, or you started that. What prompted you to create that protest?
Yeah, so after the non-indictment of Eric Garner, I believe it was, a friend of mine who is Eric Neubel, he decided he wanted to give people an outlet, and also just acknowledge that, like, this is a reality and students are hurting from it on campus, because, you know, with all these, like, police shootings and police killings or, like, vigilante things, campus just seems so oblivious to it, or just, you know, being willfully dense about it. So it's weird having to go to class, nobody's talking about it, but you're feeling it, and as a person of color, like, you're really feeling it. So he wanted to do something to, like, not only bring attention to campus, but also get, like, a community of people together so they can kind of heal together, at least deal with it together, acknowledge that you're dealing with it. So he staged a silent vigil, and he decided to have it on the Kohl Center lawn because there was a basketball game that night, a big one. I think we were playing Duke or something. So, like, it was a big game, and everybody was at the Kohl Center. He staged it so by the end of the game, people would be coming out, and they would see, like, these people on the lawn, like 100 or so people. And everybody gathered. I couldn't make it that night, but I know a lot of people gathered there. But later that night, I was at college library because I had to type, like, a 10-page research paper or something. And before I started, I went on to Facebook. And then I started seeing all these posts from my friends who were at the vigil, and they were talking about the different types of, like, hate that they got. They were talking about people saying things like, pants up, don't loot. Like, I hope the fire department comes and hoses you down. Things like that, like, really negative comments from people coming out of the game. A few people also joined the vigil, which was nice, but that hate was a lot more heavy, and that came to them a lot more than, like, people in support of things. And it was a silent vigil too, so everybody was just standing there, you know, mourning together. But seeing all that, then, and trying to transition back to my paper, I was just like, I can't focus on this paper anymore. There's, like, these very real issues, like, how am I supposed to write a 10-page paper? Like, black men and women are being murdered in the streets, and then there's no justice for them afterwards. Like, Eric Garner, it was on video. It was ruled a homicide. Like, the medical examiner, it was an illegal chokehold that was used. Like, there's everything, and it's all captured on video, yet it's a non-indictment. So, like, you're in this space of just, like, confusion and despair and anger, and you're feeling all these feelings, but you're still supposed to do this 10-page paper, and your teachers aren't focused on it. And, like, you know, nobody's thinking about these things. So from that moment, I just looked, like, I remember looking around college library, and it's just like, yeah, nobody cares. Like, what's happening right now? They're just doing their work. They're going about their days. And then that's the moment I was like, I wanted to do something. I want to bring, like, awareness to campus, get in people's face about it so they have to acknowledge it, and also give people the space to, like, get in other people's face. Like, I'm feeling this, and I'm not going to just let it slip through the cracks. And then I thought about how finals week was coming up, so everybody's gonna be only focused on that. And I wanted to disrupt that in a bit, you know, not as a means to, like, stop anybody from studying or being successful in the finals, but to make it known that while you're thinking about finals, I'm thinking about this person that got killed and how that could be me, or how that could be my friends or my parents, or my family, et cetera, and so on and so forth. And I wanted to bring that to campus. So from that night, I started reaching out to other first waivers, asking them, like, what do you think about doing something in the college library? I don't really know what it looks like yet, but, like, who would be down for that? And people were very willing. Like, you know, people were looking for something, a way to, you know, get involved. They were looking for direction, so everybody was willing and supportive. And I think from there, it was that I planned it for, like, a Sunday or something, December 14th, I think it was. And I think we had, like, it was like a 4-day span where I put it together. I was reaching out to a lot of people to ask their opinion on logistics and stuff. You know, I made, like, a flyer and started spreading that. And then, and, like, made a Facebook event, and that started spreading crazy. And, like, more and more people kept confirming they were going. Getting materials and signs and everything. And it all came together, and it was a lot of people showed up, and it was a pretty beautiful thing. Definitely a memorable experience for me, and from what people say, a lot of other people as well. So I'm glad that it happened, and I'm glad that it came together, that there were so many people willing to come and stand together for something that they believed in and to bring this awareness to campus. It really sprung from EJ putting together that silent vigil and people doing that backlash. I think something like that was really inevitable on campus. Like, even if I didn't do it, somebody was going to do it. Mm-hmm. I don't know when, but things were going to boil over at some point. And it could have, if it didn't happen then, it could have been something very different and probably a lot worse. It could have escalated into like violence or something. Because if we waited, more and more things would have kept dropping, you know?
Yeah.
And people would have been at an even more tense point. So who knows how it would have turned out, but it was definitely something that was inevitable and going to happen regardless of who put it together.
Since then, you've become more involved in the movement.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other events that you've either participated in or maybe led?
There's been a lot of like marches around in the community and around at the Capitol and things like that, what happened after the die-in, we're focused on really changing campus for students of color and, closing those gaps and making it a more equitable place. But then you get into this semester, and as you're starting to move on those things, the budget news drops.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's a whole other thing. And sad to say, but like budget cuts trumps social justice any day of the week in our country and on this campus. And that's just a fact of what it is. So then everybody's attention shifts. And it's just like, oh, Scott Walker's doing this. We gotta stop this. So then people started gathering. The TAA got people together and there's like a Save RUW group and everybody's focused on that. And I started getting involved in that because one, the budget is a huge issue. But two, I wanted to make sure that how it would affect students of color was being brought up. And I know largely it wouldn't be unless somebody was an active voice for that. So I wanted to be that. So I was, I spoke at like a rally for that. Was a part of some, helped organize a slate of people to run for ASM so we can have that in place. And they all got on, which was great. So now we have students who are connected to students of color communities, who are students of color themselves, or allies, who are actually gonna be in a position to help make change and help make ASM an actual active community, like influence body, where people actually know what it is or what it does or how it operates and what they're doing. Because it's largely disconnected from the campus, although it's student government. It's not that connected to campus. Most people don't know what's going on, nor do most people care. Like, if you look at the election results,
right,
most people don't vote on campus. You'll get like 1,500 people to vote out of the 42,000. And because people just don't know what an ASM is. But, we have people there now as a means to help foster change in the future. Hopefully, if ASM is still a thing after the budget cut comes through, because
right,
that's on the chopping block. I've done work around the budget. Then from the budget, people started getting more nuanced about how there are things on the chopping block, like the sexual assault stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that affects a whole community of like women, which is a ridiculous thing to cut because sexual assault is prevalent on college campuses. And this being a college campus, it's an issue here. It happens. I have friends who have stories about it, and that's the reality. And it's a sad thing that the orientation materials, the informant, I'm like, that's not enough in itself. But to cut that, or to even think, like even to speak something like that, it's just a terrible thing. And that's a part of the chopping block for the budget. Then there's also the minority and disadvantaged student recruitment and retention, which is on the chopping block. Like, they don't have to have the legal responsibility to recruit minorities, which is a huge issue. And that's just like pushing people out. Like, these are already such small programs, underfunded, and not really university supported in many ways. But then to just not have a responsibility to, like, I don't have to, so who says they will? So all these things, people are starting to focus on, these nuanced issues within it. And then, like, the Tony Robinson shooting happened. So there's things continue to pile up, and I do work in each area, and I really want to connect the issues. I haven't had a chance to, because I'm trying to build an organization, which is CEACE, which is Students for Climate and Education Equality. And I want to build an that organization as like a central hub for these issues on campus, for like issues like social justice and whatever it's affecting, whether it's like sexual assault things and you want to get people involved or get information out there, or if it's like student of color issues or whatever it is, just so people have a central place to come and get that information dispersed, or a central place to come where you can connect to other organizations, because that's missing on campus. Many of these organizations, most organizations on campus, don't talk to each other on like an institutional level. You know, everybody has friends like all over, but they don't talk about like what their programs are doing and stuff. You see it most evident like when people plan their calendars. There'll be 5 events in one day from all these different orgs, but you have to choose then. So like BSU will still get black students, and Metro will still, you know, only get a certain amount of students or a certain kind of student, and people can't like cross over or get to know about other cultures or other people, you know, which is a problem, which is why when it comes to like people trying to do things on campus and make change happen, nobody's connected to it because people don't know what that issue is or who you are, you know. So it's just why like people fighting for like labor stuff have a hard time getting people to come out, because people just don't know what that is and they're not connected to it. They don't understand how that's connected to what they're dealing about. Like, they don't understand how like a minimum wage is connected to like a Tony Robinson shooting type of thing. How all those issues impact the black community, and there's all these systematic things and so on and so forth. So I want to start to connect people, but it's a long process, because there's really no like foundation for it on campus. This campus, although it has a history of like activism and stuff, it's moved away from that. There hasn't been big things happening really, and there's definitely no organizations for it anymore. There used to be the MCSC, but that was dismantled. I don't know, a year or two ago. I don't know exactly when, but now it's largely just an organization in name only. So there's really not anything surrounding it. So you have to build, and with that, it's the hardest part has been finding the right people. And it's not that necessarily like people don't want to do it; it's that they can't handle it, because it's such a time commitment, and it's also just you got to be just dedicated. And I know a lot of people who've said they were willing had to pull out because they can't balance it with like whatever the schoolwork, the emotional weight of everything that's happening right now, you know what I mean? All these things, people need to take care of themselves. So it's been hard to find the right people to really get it jump started. But you know, we're trying and we're building. And you know, I've done speaking engagements, workshops, a lot of marches, rallies, been involved in community organizing with different leaders. There's upcoming stuff planned to help these high schoolers get through the Tony Robinson shooting, because a lot of them knew him personally, or, you know, that hits a lot closer to home for them. So we've gotten them involved in, like, the marches and stuff, which has been beautiful. But we also gotta heal and give them spaces to, you know, heal and build. So, you know, connecting with all different types of organizations, community organizations like, you know, Boys and Girls Club and different fraternities and sororities and Young Gifted and Black, and, you know, a lot of people in the community, like community leaders, are like coming together now, and I've been included in that. So like I'm in those discussions as well. So I've been involved in a lot. It's been a busy semester.
Doing a lot of things. You've mentioned Tony Robinson a few times now. Why don't we talk a little bit more about that, I guess, about the incident, but also kind of just how you heard about it and just general feelings around the situation.
Yeah, I remember the night. It was Friday. We were at Just Bus, which is First Wave's monthly open mic. And it was like so much happening, and everybody really needed that night. I remember that feeling, just like, oh, this is just gonna be like a good night to unwind, just take in some art. Like, you know, it's a friendly, like family kind of environment. There's music playing, people like doing poetry, and we're all just having a good time enjoying it. And I remember sitting there, and then I, like in between people at the mic, I pulled out my phone, and I think I saw somebody post that like a black kid got shot in Madison. And then I tried to click on like the article link, but it wouldn't let me. And then he was at the Just Bus too, so he pulled me to the side at once and told me, like, did I hear about it? And I was like, yeah, but I couldn't click on a link. And he told me he deleted it because he wasn't like sure if the information was correct or not. But then I started looking into it more after that, and I started seeing the articles about it. Then my Facebook timeline started to light up, like people from Young, Gifted, and Black are like, this happened, and we're going over there. And like everybody should be going over there right now. And I just kept seeing it, and you know, that just kept spreading all across my like my Facebook timelines. So I started to tweet about it to let people know. Then I was sitting at Just Bus, and I was just like, I want to be there, but I don't have a way to get there. It was, you know, it's not super close, and this is late at night. But then there was a kid sitting there, and I think he had heard about me from different things, and he asked me, like, was I going out there? Or he told me he was going out there or something, and I was just like, can I come with you? And he said I could. So me and my one other person hopped in the car with him, and we drove out there to the, you know, scene. And yeah, it was a lot of people out there that night. People, his family, friends, like they were out there crying, angry. People were out there just demanding answers, wanting to know what happened or why the police had the whole street blocked off so you couldn't get like close to the house or anything. And they formed like a line to block to make sure nobody got on that street. Tensions were really high. There were some people in the crowd who almost fought, because I remember there was one woman who came up, and she walked up to each officer on that line, shook their hand, and said, thank you. And regardless of what she meant by that, in that situation, where everybody, like, this, like, his grandmother was there, yeah. And, you know, her grandson just got shot, and he died. And for you to do that, regardless of, like, you know, like, people aren't out there, like, oh, some people feel like, yo, fuck, all the police are bad, whatever. Most people aren't out there because of that. They're like, why does this keep happening? Yeah. And they're like, you're a part of this system. Acknowledge that. We want answers. What's going on? So whatever she was doing, that was just, like, the wrong time to do it. So, like, that would almost blew up into something where, like, people, she almost got into a fight. Like, people were threatening her and stuff like that. I remember stepping in between that to make sure nothing happened, because if anything happened to her, regardless or whatever, it would turn into something more, because then the police have to step in, the tensions are already high, more people would step in, and it would turn into a whole other incident, more people would get hurt, it could lead to more deaths. So it was a really tense night. And we were out there till like 3 a.m., because we also went to the county building where they had some of his friends, like they were holding him for questioning or something. So that was the whole thing. And it was just a long night. I remember driving back, when we were going to the county building actually, and seeing people like dressed up in costumes coming and going to parties. And I just thought, like, we live in such parallel realities. There's all these people right now mourning the death of this kid and demanding answers and wondering why this keeps happening. And you have the luxury to just party on a Friday night. And that was just, like, such a surreal moment for me to see them, like, walking down, what is it, University or something by Equinox. And that was just the night didn't really feel real. I remember, like, coming in at, like, 3 a.m., and just being so exhausted. But the next morning there was like something planned, like another like rally or a meeting to come and like talk about like what happens next and everything. And it was just like so overwhelming. It's one of those moments where you wonder, like, can I do it? Like, can I even get up in the morning? It's so exhausting. Yeah. You get a few hours of sleep, but more so it's just like this work is exhausting. And like, do I want to put myself through that? And I remember that night very vividly, and I don't know, it's weird, you know, being around, like, and then you start to realize, like, some of your friends don't care, it seems like, which also puts you, like, damn, it's weird, like, you can really just exist and not be involved in some way, or do something about it, like, you don't even talk about it, and it's a weird feeling, being a part of that, so... Yeah, I don't know. And it's since then, you know, there's been a lot of things surrounding his death. More that night also, it's just nobody knew anything really about what happened. The information was so murky. And just you're hearing so many different accounts of what happened. So nobody really knew. And it stayed like that for longer than it should have. I feel like the what happened that night, or at least a more detailed account, didn't come out for a while. And I think that's part of the reason why it still feels so murky to me. Like, it still doesn't feel like the events are solidified of what happened that night. It still feels like nobody really knows. And I don't know if I can trust this account. I think it's just because they took so long to bring it, to just put the details out. Like, it's not that complicated. They know what happened. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It still feels kind of surreal. Like, a part of me still is like, I really don't know what happened that night, except that, like, he was killed, that he was shot. But yeah, there's just so much. I remember coming back, I don't know, a day or two later, and seeing the blood still on the porch. It wasn't cleaned up yet. It was just blood covering the porch. Where he after they shot him, they dragged him out of the house, like his body. And, you know, the blood was still there on the street. So, I don't know, there's been a lot. And this has been hurting a lot of people. Another moment that was pretty surreal for me is that a friend of mine had, like, messaged me on Facebook talking about it, that she was a friend of his. And that really tripped me out, because I haven't had anybody, like, close to me die because of, like, a police shooting or something. And, like, that night I was out there, like, Tony Robinson wasn't, like a real person to me almost. He's more like, he's another black person killed. It's, like, still symbolic of this larger thing. But when that came through, I was just like, wow, people really knew him. Yeah. And that was that moment for me. I was just like, damn, like, I didn't know what to say to her. Like, I didn't know how to comfort her. You know, I worked and said what I could and offered my support and everything. But it was just like, that was a really an eye-opening moment for me. Like, yeah, he was a real kid. People really knew him, cared about him, loved him, laughed with him, like, went to school with him. The day before, like, people were in class with him. And then now his life is gone, and this community just has to deal with it. So, yeah, that's.
You mentioned a few times, you know, your use of Twitter and Facebook to kind of get this news, but also just to communicate events and whatnot that have gone on, protests and marches. Do you see social media in general kind of being a big part of how this movement's been able to progress in Madison? What kind of role?
I don't know necessarily in Madison if it's been a big thing yet, but nationally it has, and that has informed Madison, because everything happened in Ferguson. And people got their news not from the news, because people didn't trust it. People were hearing so much stuff, and then they also see the news backtracks. So they go to turn to social media, particularly Twitter, to get their information. There's people who are on the ground in Ferguson. It's like, okay, I don't trust the news, but here's this person who's on the street, who's shooting a video real time, you know what I mean? And I can see what's happening. I see the tear gas being shot. I see this person being beat. You know, I see these people crying, yelling, whatever. I see the snipers on top of the cars. So I don't know what the reality is, because they're putting it out there. These people are literally on the ground, and it's real-time news. And that's continued throughout. That's been a constant thread. And most people believe those Twitter feeds a lot more than they do what national media paints. So through that, like, as you want to transpose it to Madison, people have been informed by that and kept up to date of what's going on around the nation. And that spurs you to act. So it's definitely led to Madison being more active, but I don't think it's been a huge thing here. I know for YGB, they do post a lot on social media, but I don't know how much, like, people actually attach to it. I see some people, but, you know, most people in the community probably aren't in those networks, and they operate mostly in the community. As far as campus, a lot of information spreads through social media, but it's still not enough. Because a lot of people aren't aware of things. So it's really important, but unless you're all the way at, like, unless you're a Ferguson, it's not a super efficient means, because, like, everybody's watching Ferguson, you know? But not everybody, even people in Madison, are watching stuff about Madison. So it's not a super efficient method of getting information out to people. And that's one of the problems we've had in Young, Gifted, and Black, and everybody's had, is just how do you tell everybody about what's happening? Whether that be, like, there's this action happening, or there's this education that you need, like, learn about this. So I think the role in Madison will grow as these actions keep happening and things shift so drastically as time progresses, and people will be more in tune, and it'll get easier because you start to build those networks and it'll spread. But definitely necessary to have multiple ways to spread that information.
So, looking forward, where do you see things heading with the protests and whatnot, both on campus and in Madison? I mean, you mentioned there's already some things in the works for the future, but I don't know if you want to talk about any of those in specifics or just kind of general ideas of where things can go.
You know, I'm not sure. I think that since everything happened, people are listening. I think from what happened on campus, administration is listening, and now we have access that wasn't there before. Like, I know I can get meetings with administrators, and other students can do that now, and administration is more willing to have and actually listen to students. So I think that's an avenue we can keep pressuring. So I think in time, we could enact real change on campus, like, you know, policy change. They have the diversity framework that's coming out. I think we can actually make that a legitimate, you know, exercise, rather than the university being able to just say, hey, we did something, so you can't blame us. We can actually put, like, genuine student voice into that. So I think there could be a lot of change if students are willing to put in the work. Now, I think they are. I think they just need direction again, which is why building something for people is so important, because people are definitely willing, and a lot of people hit me up and just like, yo, tell me what I can do. So you just need something to be able to tell them what they can do.
Yeah.
As far as the community, that's a whole other beast, because that's like the real world. That's, you know, it sounds corny to say it, but it is. Like, the issues are so ingrained and so much bigger. Like, UW-Madison is UW-Madison. The systems are UW-Madison. But in Madison, the systems are Madison, are Dane County, are Wisconsin, are the United States. And that's a whole larger thing to tackle. So when you're talking about, like, police brutality and mass incarceration.
I'm just going to pause this for a second.
Yeah.
All right, sorry about that little interruption.
Yeah, like I was saying, like, the problems in Madison are just so much bigger. So when we talk about police brutality and mass incarceration, it's like, it's not like, oh, you know, Madison police are, they just hire inherently bad people. It's the, like, they're influenced by these systems and mentalities and morals and visuals that are a part of, as much as a part of American culture as anybody, like one person is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the criminalization of blackness is just so well ingrained. I know for the Tamir Rice shooting, 12-year-old boy playing with a toy gun in the park, 12 seconds after a police car pulled up, he was dead. And when they reported it in, it was like shots fired, black male, maybe 20. He was a 12-year-old boy. So that's a deeply ingrained mental thing. That, like, how people view black bodies and brown bodies in America, right? So that's what you're dealing with when you get out into the community, which leads to the shootings, which leads to the mass incarceration, which leads to all these other disparities. So that's, I don't know how that progresses or what that looks like, because that gets into the national thing too. I think we can make progress and make change. But then also, it's just, I don't know what an equal America looks like either. Never had one. There's no, like, blueprints for it. I don't know. But I think they also have a real opportunity if they keep going, if they keep pressuring. And if people understand that protests are a small part of change, they're not gonna get change. But they do raise awareness, whether that's within a community or on a national thing, and they put pressure on people. So then you take that pressure and you have to start working on, like, the legislation and getting laws changed. Martin Luther King, I think he said in one of his speeches, like, I can't, like, make a man, like, love me or something, but I can make sure he doesn't lynch me, like, legally. And that's what happened, you know what I mean? Like, there's racists, there's always gonna be racists. Somebody's always gonna look at me as, like, a lesser, at least in my lifetime. That's not gonna change in my lifetime. But you can make laws where, like, that's a problem. Or you can create a criminal justice system where somebody who shoots a man on camera, chokes a man to death on camera actually gets, you know, criminal charges pressed against him. You can make that legal system. Now, he can still look at me, however, but you can put that in place. And with that, eventually that mentality changes as well, because people are understanding, you know, it's not okay to shoot unarmed black kids in the nation, and it's an actual problem. So those are the type of steps I need to be taking. And it's a lot of work, and it's exhausting work, and it's really big, you know, the concepts of wrapping your mind around it. And nobody has the answers.
Right.
But we know that we can't sit by and let what's happening keep happening. You can't be quiet about it, or else nothing is ever going to change. So that's the point that everybody's at right now.
So you see yourself still remaining pretty heavily involved going forward, at least during your time here at UW-Madison, with bringing these changes about?
Yeah, I definitely hope to, unless something drastic happens.
Right.
I plan to, because I think, you know, it's not like I want to be doing this work. You know, like, people don't want to have to march or, like, talk about the death or whatever, or go sit into, like, a legislator's office and have to campaign for, like, a civil rights act or something. Like, people don't want to have to do that. But things happen and you end up doing it because you feel like you can make change, and that's important. So I feel like I can do something here. And I've been wrestling a lot with the idea lately of, like, what if I do all this work and nothing happens? Could I be satisfied with instilling hope in people? Because I know I've done that, because people have said that. Like, a lot of people after the die-in, that was the first time they felt proud to call themselves a Badger. So, like, there's hope for change on campus. Is that enough? But then I think back to how many other people have said that. Like, even if I don't do it, somebody else will. And I was just like, how long can we wait for somebody else? How long if that's no longer okay? So I don't know. I'm grappling with that a lot, but I plan to keep working until I can't, because I think I can do some good here along with all these other people that helped and put in that work, because you can't do it by yourself. I definitely can't do it by myself. I wouldn't be able to stay a student and work a job and do art and all this other stuff if it was just me, and I would go crazy and I wouldn't help anything. So yeah, just with all the right people around me and the right people willing to put in the time and work, I plan to just keep pushing, and I think it'll pay off before I leave this campus.
I certainly hope so. Well, that's the end of the questions that I had. Do you have anything you would like to add before we end the interview? Anything I didn't touch upon, or anything you'd like to expand on?
No, I think I'm good. I think we covered it.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm just going to stop the recorder now.